A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
Today we are going back into the History Hit archive once more, and for me this one is a real treat, because in my opinion this is one of the most extraordinary campaigns in Roman military history. At the start of the 3rd century AD, a Roman emperor came to Britain at the head of a huge army and navy. The emperor's name was Septimius Severus, the African emperor, and he came to Britain to launch a couple of campaigns north of Hadrian's Wall against some troublesome tribes situated in what is now central Scotland. And in today's podcast, Dan Snow is joined by the one and only Simon Elliott, the author of a book all about Septimius Severus in Scotland, to talk through these campaigns.
Simon, thanks for coming back on the podcast. Now, you have got a forgotten towering figure of British but also world history to talk about this time. Tell me about him.
Well, this is Septimius Severus. So let me give a bit of perspective first, Dan. Septimius Severus was one of the great warrior emperors who hacked his way to power in AD 193. And in so doing, this is the year of the five emperors. He fought off all challengers and then embarked on successful wars of conquest. In the east, where he fought the Parthians and other Easterns, he actually sacked the Parthian capital, which very few Roman emperors did. And he campaigned in Africa, where he was a native, because he was born in the blistering heat of a North African summer to one of the richest families in the empire. Punic origin, so his forebears were Phoenicians, and he died in the freezing cold of a Yorkshire winter in AD 211, which, as I always say, was the Wild West of the Roman Empire if you're in the north of Britain. This never conquered part of the Roman Empire where they always struggled. But the reason he was there was to actually try and do the last major attempt to conquer Scotland, when he took 57,000 men in AD 209 and AD 210 in two campaigns to try and achieve what no emperor had done before. And he failed. That's the key thing. He failed, even though he took this enormous army, which must have been one of the, if not the largest campaigning army on British soil. He still failed. But in the second campaign in AD 210, he gave a really, really significant order when he got so fed up with the fact he couldn't conquer the north that he gave this a genocidal order, which basically said kill everybody. And after the campaigns had finished, even though he'd failed to conquer Scotland, because he died actually in York in AD 211, even though he failed to conquer Scotland, there's now coming to light archaeological data to show there was a major depopulation event in Scotland for about 80 years. So this is one of the great, great, great untold stories of British history, which I tackle now in my new book, Septimius Severus in Scotland, The Northern Campaigns of the First Hammer of the Scots.
Glad you got the pitch in there, buddy. So this is absolutely remarkable. So he fought from the very eastern end of the Roman Empire right to the west. Yeah. And he died in Yorkshire. I mean, it's also easy to forget, isn't it? It's remarkable. So tell me, what was the status when he came to the throne? What was the status of the Roman border at the north of Britannia with Scotland today or Caledonia beyond?
Well, the two tribes we're talking about now, for a start, it's very interesting, because when you talk about the Agricolan campaigns to try and conquer Scotland in the late 1st century AD, there's a broad term, the Caledonians, describing a variety of tribes. But by the time of 100 years later, these are coalesced into two broad tribal confederations. One were called the Maetae, who were based in the Midland Valley. So that's around the Antonine War, probably. And then you had the Caledonians to the north, who were in the northern Midland Valley. So that's the northern lowlands, and then in the highlands as well. And you had campaigning in the 2nd century AD, for example, around the time of Hadrian. So you have Hadrian's Wall, for example, around the time of Antoninus Pius, etc. So you have the Antonine War, where Rome still had an interest and carried out punitive expeditions, but it doesn't look like they tried to conquer Scotland after the Agricolan campaign in the late 1st century AD. So there was interest. And it probably is this interaction with the Romans in the north which caused these confederations to come into being, the Mitre and the Caledonians. And towards the end of the second century AD, they got to such a level of organisation, which they hadn't had before, that they're actually beginning to really, really trouble the northern border. And around the time that Severus came to the throne, the governor was a chap called Clodius Albinus. And he more or less had the border secure. But in the next decade, after Severus came to the throne, that's when you started seeing trouble occurring, which ultimately led to Severus coming to Britain.
And what's the main sources for this? Is it text or is it archaeological?
It's a mix of everything, actually. I mean, one of the reasons why the Severan campaigns haven't been covered in detail to date, apart from in maybe a few academic texts and things like Britannia, is because, and very well, by the way, but only in short form, is because you only have two main and then a number of minor primary sources. The main ones are Cassius Dio and Herodian, both of who have problems as historical sources. They're near contemporaries, so they're writing about it in a near contemporary way, and Dio actually knew Severus. And then you have a number of later, sort of late Roman sources, 100, 200 years later. So therefore, there wasn't that much of a spotlight apart from on a few key facts. However, in the last 10 to 15 years, a lot of data has come through to us from the archaeological record due to some fantastic excavations and investigations in Scotland, which has enabled us to look at what probably really happened and what's enabled me to actually interpret the campaigns in my own way. Principally, you're looking at marching camps. And there are a lot of sequence of Roman marching camps in Scotland. Marching camps are built at the end of a marching day by the Roman military when they're in enemy territory to defend themselves. And in Scotland, given the size of the force Severus had, it's become apparent to match the larger marching camps to the Severan campaigns so you can actually track his routes. And then on top of that, there's been major investigations on some of the campaigning sites across Scotland, which has enabled us to use analogy to show how the war would have been fought as well. So, for example, there's a hill fort which was assaulted by the Romans in the Antonine period, where that's now been properly investigated north of the border, and it shows that what the Romans were doing was an absolute blitzkrieg, taking these settlements out.
So let's just go back a little bit. So why do we think Severus decided to launch these huge, expensive campaigns in the most unfashionable part of the British Empire?
Very well put, Dan. It's worthwhile stepping back ever so slightly to answer your question. So it's worthwhile looking at where Severus came from. It gives you real insight into what he was doing. So he was born in AD 145 in Lepsius Magna, one of the richest parts of the Roman Empire, in the heat of a blistering summer. Family was Punic, as I mentioned. As an aristocrat, he was one of the first in his family, not the first, but one of the first to become a senator. He made steady progress on the cursus honorum and always had an eye for the main chance, although it's only later in life that he developed this militaristic streak. His first major command was the commander of the Legio for Scythica in Syria, where he was the legate in charge of it in the AD 180s. His first province, though, is very important to us. His first province as a governor was Gallia Lugdunensis, which is northwestern Gaul, whose capital was modern Lyon. Now, that obviously is in northwestern Gaul. That looks out towards Britannia to the north. And actually, you recall our previous conversation about the Classis Britannica, that was in charge of controlling the continental coast as well. So therefore, you have this guy for the first time from North Africa looking north towards Britain. This would be in the late AD 180s. And he became good friends with the British governor called Pertinax, who had a big falling out with the Roman military. One legion apparently rebelled against Pertinax as the governor in Britain and tried to kill him. So from the off, the context that Severus had with Britain was a negative context. And then he ended up in the late AD 180s, very importantly, being the governor of Pannonia Superior, which is the crucial province on the Danube, which guards the northeastern approaches to Italy. And that's where he's sitting in AD 192 at New Year's Eve when Commodus is assassinated, the emperor, and there's a scramble for power. So this is the year of the five emperors, AD 193. Pertinax becomes the emperor, falls out with the Praetorian Guard, gets killed. So Severus's friend Pertinax is killed by the Praetorian Guard. Severus, therefore, gets declared the emperor by his legion in his headquarters on the Danube, and he launches a blitzkrieg assault on northern Italy, gets into Rome, stages a coup, and ultimately in the year of the five emperors, he's the winner. And you can tell the contempt he had for the political classes in the Rome, because if you look at his arch, the Arch of Septimius Severus in the Forum, it's built effectively almost on the foundations of the Curia Senate House. So it's one of these key Severan things that he always says, you remember who's in charge, it's me. And then Britain comes back into the picture yet again, because in AD 196, the British governor, Clodius Albinus, who I mentioned earlier, rebels and usurps because he feels threatened by Severus. He takes his three legions, the Legio 20 Valeria Victrix from Chester, the Legio 2 Augusta from Caelion, the Legio 6 Victrix from York. He takes them to the continent and they fight this apocalyptic battle at Lugdunum near Lyon in AD 197, which Severus only wins by the skin of his teeth. So again, his context for Britain is a negative one. And he sends military inspectors to Britain at the end of the campaign to rebuild the military in Britain, but in his own way, so the law to Severus. And you can see very physically in London the evidence of this, because the Severan land walls in London, that great section I've spoken about to you before outside Tower Hill Tube Station, that was built by Severus to tell the people of London, whose governor had rebelled against him, you remember who's the boss. It's the same as the arch of Severus in the Forum in Rome. So we go forward to AD 207. And the province, I think, is still really struggling to rebuild itself after the Albion, Clodius Albinus revolt. I don't think Severus actually wanted to put the full military a presence back as it had been, and he may have left the northern frontier unmanned. So you have in the late AD 90s, the governor then, Lupus, having to buy off the Caledonian and Mitre to keep them quiet. However, in AD 207, Severus gets this letter, according to Herodian, who's not a very good source, by the way, but we'll go with him, gets this letter from Herodian, which says the province, then this is very important, this is, the whole province is in danger of being overrun. So it's not the north. He says the whole province has been in danger of being overrun. So this is a really powerful letter to Severus. And the governor's called Senecio at this time. And he finishes the letter by saying, I need help from you or reinforcements. This is AD 207. And what Severus does, he says, you can have both. So that's what the historical sources say the reason he came over for was. However, the context is that he may have left the northern border undermanned. And there's one final point to remember, and this is the Mitre and the Caledonians themselves. These are confederations which had only just come into being, sort of in the last 20 or 30 years. They're mentioned first in the AD 180s. And clearly there's a degree of political organisation which was better than was there before, so the population was growing. They'd also got used, the elites had got used to these vast sums of money from the Romans that had bought them off in the AD 190s. But also, our sources tell us that the weather at the time, this is in the late AD 200s, was very, very, very poor, really, really poor. So there may have been some kind of harvest problem. So from a native's perspective, they are a growing population. They are used to Roman wealth and might want more. But also, they may have decided that actually we're suffering here, we may have a harvest problem, so we need to go south to get food. All these things coalesce into Severus arriving in Britain in AD 208 with his 50,000 men.
So he's got 50,000 men with him. There were always, well, usually three legions stationed in Britain, weren't there?
Yeah, absolutely.
So how many men would that be?
Well, three legions is about 15,000 men, and you can add to that about 15,000 auxiliaries who were still full-fat auxiliaries that we know and recognise from the Roman Principate. And then other ancillary troops as well. So there's going to be a garrison in Britain of up to 30,000 men. But when Severus arrives, he brings with him the Praetorian Guard, which he, by the way, reformed completely after becoming the emperor in AD 193. He brings with him his Imperial Guard cavalry. He brings with him his pet new Roman legion, the Legio II Parthica, one of three Parthica legions which he formed to do his eastern campaigns. Again, crucially for Severus, gives us great insight into him. Most legions at this time are still based near the frontiers. Severus bases Legio II Parthica, 30 kilometres from Rome. Why? To tell the people in Rome, you behave or else. It's exactly the same as the Arch, exactly the same as the walls of London. But he brings them all to Britain. And also the sources tell us that he brings vexillations of troops from the Rhine and the Danube as well. So if you put all that together, it looks like around 50,000 men, I would argue, in the book. And I go into detail. Plus, you have the 7,000 men of the Classis Britannica who played a crucial role in the campaign as well. And this all arrives in the Great Estuary in East Anglia and Brough on Humber and in South Shields and in Wall's End. South Shields actually becomes one of the crucial ports where the granaries were increased in size by a factor of 10 to support his campaigns.
How's it? My name is Lassetti. I'm a tour leader with Explore. Come on, let me show you something. Oh, careful. Can you see it? Oh, trust me. It can see you. There, between the trees. It's not every day you get to see a rhino on a walk. I guess not everyone is taken to the right places, but you will be if you explore. For global adventures, search exploreworldwide.com and don't just travel. Explore.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This is After Dark, Myths, Misdeeds, and the Paranormal.
The podcast that takes you to the shadiest corners of the past, unpicking history's spookiest, strangest, and most sinister stories. I'm Maddie Pelling.
And I'm Anthony Delaney. Join us every Monday and Thursday, and we'll take a look at the darker side of history, from haunted pubs to Houdini to witch trials and arsenic-laced breakfasts.
Follow After Dark, Myths, Misdeeds, and the Paranormal wherever you get your podcasts. Brought to you by History Hit.
So you're telling me that one of the most powerful men in the world at the time spent a long time in the north of England and in Scotland with the largest army ever assembled in that
Absolutely
part
right.
of the world. It's just a fascinating story.
Well, it's astonishing, and it's also the last 3 years of his life. I mean, the primary sources talk about the fact that he didn't expect to go home either. This is an interesting take on the psychology of the man, okay? If you look at the Roman poet Horace, who wrote in the sort of like a very early Principate period, around the time of his emperor was Augustus, he had a poem where he said Augustus would not be a god unless he conquered the Parthians, the Persians, and conquered the Britons, okay? Well, Severus, to his mind, had conquered the Parthians. He'd actually sacked their capital. So he chose the last 3 years of his life to actually come to Britain to try and also finish off the conquest of the province of Britannia. And remember, he probably initiated the separation of the province of Britannia into two. So it's the first time, it's under his son, eventually it takes place, Caracalla. It's the first time that you end up with inferior in the north, with York as its capital, and London in superior in the south. So he deliberately chose to spend the last 3 years of his life in Britain, and he actually turned York into the imperial capital. We know this because the primary sources say that he didn't just bring the military, he brought his wife, Julie Domna, who's a very, very famous lady in the context of Roman leaders, played a major role in influencing the policy decisions of her husband. He bought his sons Caracalla and Geta, that were continually squabbling. He bought the imperial fiscus treasury. He bought the treasury with him, Dan. And he bought some of the key senators, and he bought his entire court with him. And he turned the Principia, the headquarters building, in the legionary fortress in York, which is now beneath York Minster, into the imperial Roman capital. So you'll have gone to York, you'll have seen that massive column, which is out next to the statue of Constantine outside the Minster. That's from the Basilica of the Principia, which he built. And it has been estimated that that basilica, which he built, as part of it being part of his imperial capital, would have been almost as tall as the Minster is today.
Amazing. God. Right, so what about his campaigns? What's he do?
Well, it's a very asymmetrical campaign on paper. He's got his 50,000 men. He's got the Classis Britannica on the east coast. So what he does, he basically marches up Deer Street, goes through Corbridge, goes through the wall, enters the Scottish borders, and then eviscerates everything in his way, completely scours the place clean. We know his route because here he built a sequence of marching camps up to 70 hectares in size, which would take his entire 50,000 force. So one of them, for example, is at Newstead. There's another one at St. Leonard's. There are two more north of that. And very interestingly, Vindolanda at this time, which is the fortress south of Hadrian's Wall, which predates Hadrian's Wall, In its Antonine form, which is the one that we see today in the excavations, he actually flattened it, and he actually made a plateau out of it. And then what he did, he actually built hundreds of late Iron Age roundhouses on top of it, laid out to a Roman grid pattern. So it looks like that could have been something like a concentration camp for the natives in the borders, and he just sent them south. Completely eviscerated the place. Gets to Inveresk, crosses over the river there, and continues westward now on Deer Street, gets to the Roman fort at Antonine fort at Cramon, which he rebuilds. And when he rebuilds it, he turns it into a major supply base. So now we have two links in the supply chain. We have South Shields, and then we have Cramond on the Forth. He then builds a bridge of boats across the Forth, up to 500 boats, and probably along the line of the Forth Railway Bridge today, actually, I would argue. And then he divides his force into two-thirds and one-third, and he sends his son, I argue, his son Caracalla, eldest son, with two-thirds of the force to go to the Highland Boundary Fault, so the Highland Line, and then he marches them southwest and northeast on the Highland Boundary Fault, sealing off the Highlands. And so the lowlands are sealed off to the southeast, and the Highlands are sealed off to the northwest. And he builds a series of, Caracalla builds a series of 45-hectare marching camps, which can take two-thirds of the force to seal off all the glens effectively. So all the people south, so the Mitae around the Antonine Wall, and the Mitae and Caledonians in the lowlands above, they're now sealed in. And he also locks them in on the sea as well by using the Classica Britannica. And eventually the Navy and Caracalla's legionary spearheads meet somewhere near Stonehaven on the coast. So now the whole of the lowlands, this is, by the way, AD 209, the whole of the lowlands are now sealed off. So there's no way any Caledonians north in the Highlands can get into there, and everybody in the south is sealed off. Severus then himself takes his one-third of the force, which would probably be the elite troops, the Praetorian Guard. I would argue that it's the three British legions who were with Caracalla, because they were used campaigning in the region. So Severus now has his two Parthica, he has the Praetorian Guard, the Imperial Guard cavalry, equal number of auxilia. He goes with his third of the force, crosses the bridge himself, but instead of going on the Highland Boundary Fault, he just bangs straight through Fife. Builds two 25-hectare marching camps, which we know of, to show the route. And then he gets to the old Antonine harbour and fort on the Tay, which is called Carpal. And again, he rebuilds it. So you now have the third link in the supply chain. So you now have South Shields, Cramond, Carpal. And then once he gets to the Tay at Carpal, he then builds his own bridge of boats across the Tay. And then he slams into the soft underbelly of the Mitae and the Caledonians in the Midland Valley, and brutalizes the place. Now, the thing is, there's no set-piece battle, unlike Agricola with Mons Graupius. The historians say there was no set-piece battle, so you just have a brutal campaigning season of guerrilla warfare, absolutely brutal, in terrible weather conditions. All the primary sources say the weather conditions were bad. They say that the natives were better at fighting these conditions than the Romans. And actually, Dio says the Romans suffered 50,000 casualties, which is a bizarre number because that's the whole size of the fighting force. But that's literary license to show how brutal it was. But at the end of the first season, the campaign is won in some shape or form, probably ceding Fife and the Scottish borders to Rome, because coins are minted saying Severus and Caracalla have been successful, and a peace is agreed. And the northern frontiers are garrisoned properly, maybe even the Highland Boundary Fault. Marching camps are maintained with garrisons, but the majority of the force then head home for the winter to winter in AD 209-210 in York. So the season one is done. Peace is agreed. Looks like Severus can say, I've conquered Britain. But it's not over, because across the winter, the Mitae rebel again. They're clearly not happy with the terms they've got. And when they rebel, Severus realises he's got to go back again. Now, bear in mind, Severus, like, he's in his early 60s. He's riddled with chronic gout. He's carried on a sedan chair for the whole of his first campaign. So he's really, really fed up with them rebelling again, and the Caledonians predictably join them. So he says, right, we'll go again. We'll reset. It's like a computer game. Just reset it. We'll do the whole thing again, exactly the same campaign again. But this is where he gives this genocidal order. And it's very clever the way that Dio says he does it. Dio has him quoting the Iliad, where Menelaus asks Agamemnon, what shall I do with these prisoners? And this is Severus quoting, according to Dio, Homer and the Iliad to his army massed in front of him in York. And the quote goes something along the lines of, what shall I do with his prisoners? You shall kill everyone, even the babies in the mother's wombs, and similar. So it's very, very clear that an order has been given to carry out some kind of hideous genocide. Now, Severus is too ill to campaign this time, and Caracalla, who's even more hard-bitten than Severus, leads the campaign, and it's carried out in full. It's even more brutal. I mean, it's even more brutal. And this is where you have this evidence of reforestation in the lowlands. You have evidence of settlements being abandoned, etc. You have evidence of basically some kind of genocide being carried out in the lowlands. And another peace is agreed at the end of AD 210. And there's no rebellion afterwards, probably because there's no one in the lowlands left to rebel. And then Severus, I think, was going to try and keep at least five and possibly the whole of the lowlands within the Roman Empire fully manned. So if he'd have succeeded and survived, you'd have had, you know, a completely different story about southern Scotland, certainly, maybe with stone-built settlements and things like that. Whether the Picts would have come into being the same way they did is questionable. However, Severus died in February AD 211 in York.
And then what happened?
Well, I've heard earlier me talking about Caracalla and Geta permanently squabbling, permanently fighting, etc. And Caracalla in particular is quoted by the primary sources as saying that he actually almost carried out a fratricide against his father in AD 209. So he clearly wanted the throne. So you can almost imagine him as the Joaquin Phoenix character in Gladiator, looking towards his father, Marcus Aurelius, wanting the throne. Well, that's that kind of picture we're painted with Severus and Caracalla. Severus dies, and there's an almost unseemly scramble then from Caracalla and Geta to get back to Rome to try and take over the sole role of the emperorship. Now, Severus wanted them both to rule, but clearly this wasn't going to happen, and ultimately, by the end of the year, Caracalla had actually killed Geta. Apparently, Geta dying, bleeding with stab wounds in his mother's arms in Rome. So as soon as Severus was dead, they completely lost interest in the campaign. The Roman forces went back to their bases. The Vexillations went back to the Rhine and the Danube, probably couldn't wait to get back given the weather conditions. And then the border was reset on Hadrian's Wall again. But what we do know is that there was 80 years of peace, apparently because of the archaeological record, etc., in the lowlands, certainly in the north of Britain after the campaigns. So the actual outcome of the campaigns wasn't the conquest of Scotland. It was just probably the longest period of comparative peace on the northern border in modern history.
Brutal pacification.
Total.
An extraordinary story. Thank you for sharing that. Just quickly, what was what's Severus's legacy more broadly in terms of Roman history?
I, as a military historian, look at his impact on the Roman military. And he was the first of the great reforming emperors in the Principate after Augustus of the Roman military. So you could argue that the first Roman field army was actually the field army he put together for the conquest of Scotland in his Expeditio Felicissima Britannica, which is what the contemporaries call it. And if you look at the monuments in Rome, you can actually see in real time the transition taking place from the Principate to what will be the later dominate, let's say the legionaries as an example. If you look at the column of Marcus Aurelius and Trajan's column, the Roman legionaries are wearing lorica segmentata largely. They've got the classic scutum, they've got pilums and the gladius. If you look at the Arch of Septimius Severus, not that long afterwards, there are one or two figures in lorica segmentata, but they've got large oval body shields and they've got spears. And if you look closely, you can see a lot of the legionary figures are depicted in long thigh-length lorica hamata chainmail coats with, again, the oval body shield and the long spear. So it looks like there's a military transition changing from what was the Principate legionary to later in the dominate, all the legionaries and all the auxilia are then armed in the same way. Let's say from the time of Constantine, with a large oval body shield, spear, lorica hamata chain mail, and the spatha, the long previously cavalry sword, the long sword, replacing the gladius. And the reason for that is probably not to do with the British expedition. It's probably Severus's experiences in the east fighting the Parthians, where they're predominantly cavalry based. And he's looking at weapons which have got longer reach. And the other point to remember is shortly after Severus's time, you have the crisis of the 3rd century, a big economic crisis, and you'll probably find this change he began accelerated because it's cheaper to maintain and make chain mails that make the oval body shields, make the spears, etc.
Well, there you go. Comprehensive. Thank you very much. What's the book called? One more time.
The book is called Septimius Severus in Scotland, The Northern Campaigns of the First Hammer of the Scots, published by Greenhill Books.
Available in all good bookshops.
Absolutely right. Absolutely right.
Thank you, Simon Elliott. Thank you so much for coming back on the podcast. Always great to have you on.
Thank you very much for having me on, Dan.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Ancients. Please follow this show wherever you get your podcasts. It really helps us and you'll be doing us a big favour. Don't forget, you can also listen to all of these podcasts ad-free and watch hundreds of documentaries when you subscribe at historyhit.com/subscribe. As a special gift, you can also get your first 3 months for just £1 a month when you use code ANCIENTS at checkout.